This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today on the origins of the species seekers, we'll hear about the dashing naturalists who risked their lives to catalog the natural world. Also, there's no escaping our continuing fascination with Harry Houdini and Apple's next move in the post-Jobs era. But first, an innovative prevention-centric model with a proven record for providing healthcare for Medicare patients. CareMore was launched 18 years ago and guided by the principle that you can fix a problem early on for a buck or fix it 10 steps later for 30. CareMore's focus on sharing patient information, rapid treatment of minor ailments, and high-tech patient monitoring help prevent procedures, expensive procedures, and it's profitable. By shifting from a fee-for-service incentive to collaborative, patient-focused care, elderly patients have shorter hospital stays, fewer catastrophes, and overall member costs of 18% below the industry average. CareMore was bought in August by WellPoint, provider to some 70 million Americans. Adrian Slavatsky is author of the new book, Demand, Creating What People Love Before They Know They Want It, an excerpt from his book about whether the CareMore model can be scaled up for the coming silver tsunami is in the Atlantic. Adrian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Virginia. Pleasure to be with you.
So what's the main principle of the CareMore model and what makes it so unique?
You know, I think that there are three fundamental principles that have been consistently applied. The first is put the patient first. Take care of the person and good things will follow. The second is shift your focus from repairing things to prevention. And the third, even though it's run by doctors, do whatever it takes, medical actions as well as non-medical actions, to take care of the entire person. If we have to help them get to an appointment, we'll do that. We want to combine sophisticated medicine, but also non-medical things that solve the problem for the patient.
Those principles came pretty much from its founder, Dr. Sheldon Zinberg. What motivated him to start CareMore?
It's a great question. I think it was a combination of three factors. I think the first was that in the 1980s, the growth of HMOs often intruded on the way physicians practiced care. The second thing was that Dr. Zinberg saw that, you know, the dominant fee-for-service system often led to more care, but not necessarily better care. And the third, as he observed patients and he specialized in working with the elderly, he so frequently saw that he and others were treating conditions or situations that were preventable if someone had just looked a few steps earlier. And he tried to think of a way to shift healthcare from fixing bad complications to preventing them in the first place.
So back in 1993, he launched CareMore's model. You illustrate this with stories of patients. Ellen from Anaheim, for example, she's an 82-year-old widow with a heart problem. Tell us a little bit about her.
Ellen is a classic example of a patient who suffers from congestive heart failure. And for those patients, you sometimes get a buildup of fluid in the lungs, and it's critical to find out as early as possible and to treat it as early as possible. In the typical case, that doesn't happen. A patient gets into trouble, they're short of breath, and they call the emergency room. CareMore provided Ellen with a wireless scale and asked her to get on that scale every morning. One day, when the scale showed that she had gained more than 3 pounds, the nurse practitioner immediately called her, sent a car to bring her to the clinic because her daughter was away, and immediately started treating her for that condition so that it wouldn't get worse. Not a very expensive move, but it made a tremendous difference in Ellen's life.
So to be a part of the CareMore plan, Ellen and others have to agree to be monitored, which brings in this notion of compliance. You mentioned a little bit earlier, a little bit about compliance. CareMore directly intervenes and directs patient compliance. Give us some examples of that.
CareMore understands that very many of the elderly, as many as 35 to 40%, live alone, and many of them don't get to their physician's appointments. And when that happens, that only leads to bad news further down the road. So one of the things that CareMore does is for patients who can't get to the clinic themselves, it will send a car for them. That costs money, but it's much less than preventing than the cost of the downstream complications. It also provides, not for everyone, but for patients with a history of congestive heart failure, the kind of wireless scale that makes it possible for the patients to weigh themselves every morning, and the clinic immediately knows whether they're in good shape or not. CareMore also now provides wireless cuffs for monitoring blood pressure, and that has helped reduce the blood pressure of many of their most sensitive patients. So there is a whole series of things that CareMore does under a simple philosophy. They say that non-compliance is our problem, not the patient's problem, and they go out of their way to make it easy for the patient to comply.
And these are the kinds of things that maybe used to be managed by families, you know, when families lived a lot closer together. You might remind your parent, your elderly parent, to take medications. You might be the one weighing them, making sure that they're eating okay. Is CareMore sort of filling in that gap?
It's a great, great point. Yes, they are. In many cases, the elderly frail live alone. Sometimes children live in the same city and, you know, can help take them to the clinic, but often that's not the case. So CareMore tries to recognize how their patients actually live and what they really need to make sure that they are taken care of in a timely fashion. So, yes, that's well put. A lot of things that families used to do because they lived together, now they don't. CareMore recognizes that and tries to adjust for that.
We're talking with Adrian Slavatsky, who wrote about one profitable patient-focused model for treating those normally regarded as the greatest drain on our healthcare system. That's elderly Medicare patients. Another story here, because they were just so extraordinary, the story of Dan. He's an 87-year-old retired letter carrier. Tell us a little bit about his case.
It's a very, very important example because Dan, 87 years old, had weak limbs. And many physicians can tell you in advance who are the patients who are most prone to a fall. And CareMore has documented that people who are elderly, who have weak limbs, who have toenails that are too long, whose prescription glasses may be off, and who may have obstacles like shag rugs in their apartments are very, very likely to fall. CareMore works systematically against each of those things. They bring Dan in two or three times a week for light weight training to put a little bit of extra strength into his limbs. They make sure that his toenails are trimmed at the clinic once a month. They ask him to get rid of his shag rug. And so even though Dan is at high risk of fall, not only has he not fallen, but CareMore's patients experience 80% fewer falls than comparable patients in other systems. Just a quick recap of what that means. Typically, a fall means 7 to 10 days in the hospital. It means another couple of weeks in rehab at a facility, and then it means a couple of months of painful rehab at home, all of it preventable. And I think that's the focus of the CareMore philosophy.
Now, also a similar model in wound clinics for people with diabetes, you know, treating the wounds quickly, leading to 60% fewer amputations. So we see here, you write about a 97% satisfaction rate, almost idyllic. But how does CareMore make a profit?
CareMore initially struggled, but by 2000, it had become profitable and has been solidly in the black ever since. CareMore makes a profit for the following reason. It is exclusively funded by Medicare Advantage, which is a program that pays CareMore a fixed price per patient depending on the risk level of the patient. What CareMore does is it studies very carefully who are the patients most in need of care and of prevention, and it concentrates the care there. And because it is so efficient, it has the ability to reinvest in things such as bring the patient to the clinic, in things such as wireless scales and wireless cuffs. And when you study the economics, if you concentrate on the most important and the most complex cases, and if you concentrate on prevention, the patients are dramatically better off, and you can become solidly profitable as a result.
CareMore was acquired by WellPoint, which operates Blue Cross and Blue Shield, now has some 34 million subscribers and 35 million more through subsidiaries. Now, how can this patient-focused model be scaled up to those kind of numbers, Adrian?
Well, there are two to two important and very positive dimensions here. The first is that CareMore has a very careful process of scaling up. It's careful on how it hires, and it has veterans working with new physicians in a new clinic, so it has a very systematic way of doing it. If you combine that with WellPoint's knowledge of physicians and of patients in many, many local markets, WellPoint's capital and WellPoint's quite extensive health information technology resources, I think the combination of those two will make it possible to expand the CareMore model much more quickly than it would have been possible had CareMore operated just on its own.
Well, it's a fascinating model, and Adrian, I really want to thank you for joining us today and telling us about it.
My pleasure, Virginia. Thank you very much.
Adrian Savlotsky is a partner at Oliver Wyman. That's a global consulting firm. The article in The Atlantic was adapted from his book, Demand, Creating What People Love Before They Know They Want It. You'll find a link to read the complete article at wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to be back in just a minute with Life After Jobs. We'll be talking about Apple's next move. And we'll also be speaking with Siri. That's the desk assistant now included on the 4S iPhone, who has a pretty good sense of humor, I might add. That's when Word of Mouth returns on NHPR. And remember, you can always listen to us live on wordofmouthradio.org and listen to segments that we've already played and email them to your friends or sign up for a podcast. You can also sign up for NHPR's free iPhone app. That's all at wordofmouthradio.org. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. The world was thrown into technological vertigo after the death of Apple CEO Steve Jobs last month. Videos of Jobs' now legendary product introductions replayed across networks and social media, highlighting just how Apple has propelled personal tech forward in just the last 10 years. With a few weeks past, it feels like the right time to consider the identity and future of Apple in the post-Jobs era. Rob Fleischman, our go-to oracle for all things Apple, is here with some predictions on what Apple will come up with next. And Rob, it's great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
So, hit us. Can we expect another Apple game changer or maybe just some updates on their already proven innovations?
Well, I certainly don't have any inside information, but I could tell you I'm pretty optimistic that Apple is going to conquer the TV universe next.
Really? Even without Steve Jobs at the helm?
Sure. Well, you know, already on the iTunes store, you can buy videos and programs, TV shows, etc. But I think the TV device itself is really ripe for revolution.
That's funny that you say revolution, because I think of it seems almost backward, you know, from building interactive technology that is beautiful, that already integrates the viewing experience, back to the sit on the couch and flip through the channels.
Well, it's similar to what Apple did with the phone. Think about TV. TV really hasn't changed for the user much in years. People point to high definition. People point to flat screens. But the bottom line is we are standing here looking at an array of rectangular pixels. And what do? We spend our lives plugging additional things into our TV to fix the problems with it. We plug cable boxes in. We plug DVRs in. We're all plugging things into our television to address the problems with it. Our TVs really have become just a simple monitor, just really a screen that we use to view stuff from other devices.
So it's integrating all those things. So if, for example, my phone connected to my computer, connected to my TV, to my camera, so on, is that what we're looking at?
I think something similar. I view it as the following. I think that if I were to guess, I think Apple is going to evolve the iPad into something like a television.
That's what I was wondering, a big giant iPad?
Imagine if you took a giant iPad and stuck it on your wall. Of course, you'd have to have some other advances. For example, maybe every iPhone or iPod or other things could be your remote. Maybe you could use technology similar to the Nintendo Wii, where you're waving at the screen and that's able to control things. But I think something in that direction is probably coming out of the Apple labs.
So from here on out, is Apple going to be asking, you know, WWJD, what would Jobs do? I mean, what are the chances they're going to create an equally compelling identity.
Well, I think for the next few years, I would say at least for the next five, Apple is going to continue to do what it's always done. I think that they have the intellectual capital, they have the people, they have the direction to continue to do what they've been doing. Beyond 5 years, it's really hard to guess. It'll be interesting to see what their personnel does. But I think they have products for the next few years that are going to be great, and they're going to continue to be great.
Well, I understand that you have brought a friend with you today, Rob. Many of you at home may be well acquainted with our guest. Now, we've got her microphone already here. Would you like to introduce Siri to our listeners?
Sure. Let's see what she has to say today. What is your name?
My name is Siri.
Okay, so this is Siri. This is the iPhone 4S. So it's an She talks to you, Siri.
She can respond to some requests with voice. A lot of things she responds to with just displaying information on the screen. But there's quite a few things you can ask her where she'll just talk right back to you.
If your phone were stolen, would Siri respond to my voice, or is it kind of a personal thing?
No, sure. Siri is speaker independent. My phone does know that my name's Robert, and sometimes it uses my name when it answers. But it's a speaker-independent voice recognition system. And you should give it a try. Here, I'll hand it to you, and you can just push the microphone button, and Siri will listen and respond.
That's the microphone button right there.
You got it. Just push that.
Oh, and then it gives you a script of what you've said. Okay, let's see. Press the button, take my finger off it.
Yep.
Okay.
There you go.
Siri, I have a friend coming in for dinner tonight, and I was hoping to bring her someplace, maybe ethnic, near Concord.
I found a number of restaurants in Concord.
Okay, so if I press one of these, will it tell me about them, or she's just giving me the answer?
She'll give you the answer, and then it'll bring you to it.
Siri, remind me, I have to write a script for Chuck Palahniuk tonight.
Here's your reminder for today at 7 p.m. Shall I create it?
Sure. She understands, sure.
She understood tonight, too. You notice how she pulled tonight into 7 p.m.?
She did. She turned tonight into 7. Okay, all right. This is pretty good. Siri, do I need a raincoat today?
It doesn't look like it's going to rain today.
And then she pulls up the weather report. Oh, this is really good. You can have meaningful conversations. Or can they be meaningful, Rob?
Well, I'm not sure that Siri's quite that smart yet. But, you know, there is a bunch of funny things you could ask her about the meaning of life and how she feels about you. But Siri's pretty limited to its ability to access information on your phone and search the web and look at your calendars and your contacts. Siri, do you love me?
I respect you.
Will you still respect him in the morning?
Will you respect me in the morning?
I don't know what you mean by will you respect me in the morning?
Well, Rob, okay, I can understand the kind of novelty of this, right? You know, showing your friends, doing this kind of stuff. Do you really use Siri? I mean, is it just as easy for you to do a web search and send a text on your own?
You know what I've used Siri for, actually, so far, is when I'm in the car, if I remember something and need to send a message or remind myself of something later, Siri's useful.
How much of a get is this technology for Apple? I mean, we've heard voice recognition. You can do commands to your car, for instance.
Absolutely. The big innovation here is in two areas. First, as you said, voice recognition has been around for a while, and the voice recognition that Siri's using is pretty good. I wouldn't say it's the greatest in the world, but it's very good. It's pretty fast. But that's available on a lot of platforms, and you can buy voice recognition software for your computer, and a lot of mobile phones have it already, and as you said, cars have it. But the real innovation here is when Apple bought Siri the company, they got a technology that allows them really to do some understanding of words. So they got contextual analysis and the ability to take words like sure and understand that means yes in certain contexts. And that really is a huge win for Apple. And I think they're going to leverage that, and I think they're going to expand Siri throughout all the abilities the iPhone has. And you can imagine, as I talked about earlier about Apple TV, imagine the ability to command your TV via voice. And that's really going to be critical in an area where you might not have a remote. So I think that technology, the two together, are revolutionary.
So you'll be able to say, how come there's nothing good to watch on TV?
Maybe you'll be able to say, show me the things I like, or show me something good on TV, Siri, and it'll be able to take a guess.
Well, Rob, thank you so much for joining us today and for bringing Siri along. She's quite entertaining.
It was great fun. Thanks for having me. Goodbye, Siri.
Okay, Robert. See you later.
I, Rob Fleischman is a serial inventor, entrepreneur, and chief software architect at Zerocol. And Siri, the Apple iPhone 4S personal assistant, is pretty much everything from secretary to know-it-all to stand-up comedian. Siri, how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
42 cords of wood, to be exact. Everyone knows that.
That's good.
Coming up, what early naturalists had in common with James Bond, the species seekers that went to extreme lengths to change the worldview of man's place in nature. That's when Word of Mouth returns after the headlines from the BBC. This is NHPR. This is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 18th century, explorers set out to catalog the varieties of life on Earth. Until then, even educated people believed that monsters and creatures from mythology lurked outside the relative safety of their known environments. Today, there are 2 million documented species on Earth, a far cry from the 4,400 listed by Swedish botanist Carolus Linnaeus back in 1758. Even that number is astonishing, considering that the bold and great lengths a few ambitious men had to go to discover and catalog the mysteries of the natural world. The exploits of these colorful explorers play like adventure stories in a new book, The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth by Richard Conniff. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and guest columnist for the New York Times as well. Richard, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, nice to be here, Virginia.
Oh, this is such a fantastic book, and I'm looking through this marvelous illustrations as well. The first species seekers set out to explore the world in the Great Age of Discovery. So describe that time, that backdrop for us.
Well, so for these people, going out to distant corners of the Earth was more dangerous than going to the moon is for us. I mean, first of all, it would take 6 months or a year to get to some of these places. They didn't have any GPS. They didn't have any jets. They didn't have any immunizations. They didn't have any maps. They stood a high likelihood of dying. So Linnaeus sent out 19 of his students. Half of them did not come back. That was fairly typical.
What does it mean to discover a species, and how do species seekers go about it?
Well, it's a tricky question because, people who live in an area have often known about an animal for thousands of years, and then you have some European come in and say they've discovered it. It can be annoying. But discovery means describing a species in detail, showing how it's similar to other species and how it differs and how it fits into a scheme of classification. So it's no longer just local knowledge, but something that can be used anywhere in the world.
Well, there are 6 main seekers in your book, which reads, as I said, more like a series of adventure stories than scientific narrative. It was a very dangerous pursuit. Some of the side characters are also very fantastic. So let's start with where you start in the book. This is at the height of battle with a certain Colonel de Jean. Tell us a little bit about him.
So he was in the French army, and it was during the Peninsular Wars in Spain, beginning of the 19th century. And he was also a coleopterist. That is, he collected beetles. And the men who were under his command carried little glass vials, and they were told to collect anything on 6 legs that crawled or flew. And so he was going into battle one day, and he had a challenge of charging uphill into the Spanish cannons. And, the air was full of gunpowder and blood and gore. And he looks down from his horse, and he sees this beetle by a stream that he had never seen before. So he gets off his horse, collects it, pins it inside his helmet, and then gets back on the horse and says, "Charge." And in the ensuing battle, 600 of his soldiers died. His helmet was blasted to pieces, but he survived, and so did that specimen.
But he was actually beat to the jump. That's a sad part of the story.
Yeah, well, this is fairly common. He waited another 20 or 30 years before he actually got around to describing it, and then it was a synonym. That is, somebody else had already described it, and his name was kind of irrelevant.
You write in the 18th century London, this fervor that we just heard a little bit about manifested in some very strange journeys of exotic animals. Tell us, for example, why an eel was brought to London in a cask of rum.
Yeah. So they actually shipped five of them from South America, and one of them survived to make it to London. And they were interested in it because it was electrical, and everything electrical was fascinating at that time, you know, Ben Franklin and all that sort of thing. And so they sent back the one that they got finally died before they could do much with it. They sent back to South America for additional samples, and then they had a kind of party, a scientific party, where everybody gathered in this one house in London, and they had an electric eel, and one person grabbed it on one end and then held hands with 27 other people in a ring and grabbed it on the other end, and the electric shock ran through them all. And that was kind of a kick, kind of a thrill, and also told them something about the natural world that they hadn't known before, you know, that there was this electrical basis for these biological actions.
Well, and of course, that is what is at the heart here of this fervor. Yet, not every species seeker was looking for the exotic, the lion or the electric eel. Tell us about the man who came to be known as Rumphius.
So Rumphius was a Dutch-German character in the 17th century, and he was raised in the middle of the Thirty Years' War and became a mercenary and was miserable, I think, and he fled Europe, got to work for the Dutch East India Company, wound up on an island in Indonesia, and this was really 6 months and more out away from home, and fell in love with the place and the life there, stayed there, married, had children, and became fascinated with the wildlife and didn't just catalog it the way a lot of people did, you know, the species name and the descriptions, but watched how things behaved. So other people were interested in pen shells, which are shaped kind of like a quill pen, because they're pretty. And he was interested enough to watch how they lived on the bottom of a bay. And he saw that within the shell, within the pen shell, there was a little sort of ice-colored shrimp. And when there was something dangerous coming, the shrimp would pinch the shell would close up with the shrimp inside, and so they had this kind of mutual benefit relationship.
We're talking about some of the very colorful early naturalists that changed the human perspective on the world with Richard Conniff. He's a Guggenheim Fellow and a frequent NPR contributor and author of a new book called The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. Well, one of my most favorite chapters in the book talks about the conundrum of what to do with the species once they have been collected. So enter Charles Waterton. How did he come to change this game?
So Charles Waterton was, like a lot of these characters, eccentric. He was a member of the sort of British Catholic gentry and had an estate in Yorkshire. But he went over in the 1820s to South America four times, I think. And he was interested in species not so much to name them, but to bring them back to life, that is, to stuff them and arrange them in a way that actually reflected how they lived in the wild. So he spent enormous amounts of time looking at how a bird sat on a branch, for instance, and then trying to recapture that. And it was kind of like he was interested in reincarnation. So he developed new techniques for preservation, and that up until about the 1820s or 1830s, everything that you collected pretty much rotted away before too long. But about that time, arsenic came in and various other preservatives, and that made it possible to keep these things and build up large collections and make comparisons of one to another. And that really helped people understand a lot more about the natural world.
How did this sudden discovery of so many species affect the predominantly Christian, European, and American vision of God's individual divine creations?
Well, you know, we tend to think of this as a story just about the discovery of evolution by natural selection. And really, it was a lot more profound than that. And one of the big changes happened in the end of the 18th century because of a species that had been discovered in the United States. It was they called it the incognitum, but it was a mastodon. And and a French anatomist named Georges Cuvier used the mastodon and other specimens that he had of African elephants and Indian elephants and Siberian mammoths to demonstrate that the mastodon was in fact extinct. And that was a pretty profound shock because it meant that a part of God's creation had actually disappeared from the face of the earth. And up until then, everybody believed in this perfect chain of being where from the lowest creature to the highest, everything, every place, every possible place was filled and everything was sort of designed to stay that way forever. Suddenly, you know, the idea that we could disappear from the face of the earth became something you had to conjure with.
Well, now, we read one of your blog posts in the New York Times. Now, there's a terrific argument for naturalist as spy, something that you note isn't necessarily the way that naturalists view themselves. What is that connection between the two professions?
Well, so naturalists actually hate this connection because it just makes people in countries that they are trying to explore suspicious of them. But, you know, there's a long literature of it and Stephen Maturin in the novels sorry, I can't remember the name of the novels right now, but those seagoing novels written by Patrick O'Brien is this sort of typical naturalist surgeon and spy. And the ability to observe things closely in the natural world and note subtle changes over time is actually a kind of a useful skill for spying as well. And so there have been a number of cases where people either have pretended to be naturalists or naturalists have turned their skills to spying.
How many species are left yet to discover?
Well, that's a big subject of debate. So a recent study came out and said that probably we have 10 million species on Earth, so we have another 8 million to go. But others have said 50 million to 100 million. I think the point is that we really, even after 150 years of discovery, 200 years, we know very little of the natural world. And what we don't know about what's disappearing all around us right now could actually be pretty critical information.
Well, it's a fascinating story, and I really want to thank you. Great to speak with you.
Thank you, Virginia. Pleasure.
Richard Conniff, a Guggenheim Fellow, winner of the National Magazine Award and guest columnist for the New York Times. His new book is The Species Seekers, Heroes, Fools, and the Mad Pursuit of Life on Earth. You can find more on the book, including some terrific reviews at wordofmouthradio.org. And don't forget that you can seek us on Facebook and on Twitter. No life or limb required. Coming up, a museum exhibits the trickery that keeps Harry Houdini cemented as a legend in the imaginations of millions. We're going to hear about that after this brief escape. You're listening to Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. Welcome back. Eric Weiss's name may escape your memory, which is only fitting since he was much better known as Harry Houdini. A new exhibition at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco explores the life and legacy of the famed escape artist. And KALW's brother and sister team, Molly and Seth Samuel, went in search of the Houdini mystique for Cross Currents.
There's a Houdini quote printed on the wall as you enter this gallery at the Contemporary Jewish Museum. It says,
"Will wonders never cease?"
They won't. Not in this show, anyway. It doesn't reveal anything about how Houdini did his tricks.
It does explore why he did them, and what he meant, and actually still means to people.
Dara Solomon is a curator at the museum. She meets us up front for a tour.
Houdini was born in Budapest in Hungary, and he came over to the United States with his family when he was about 4 years old. He was born in 1874.
Houdini's given name was Eric Weiss. The family moved to America when his father, a rabbi, was hired by a synagogue in Wisconsin.
The job didn't pan out, and they ended up in New York. Houdini, some of his brothers, and his dad started working in a factory.
The magic part's coming soon, don't worry.
Yeah, soon. Here's Dara Solomon.
He very early, as legend goes, was interested in performing, doing backyard performances, and also interested in locks and unlocking things that people would lock up, and he would, you know, surprise them and be able to open the locks.
Was he a lawbreaker? Why did he like locks?
No, I think like his mother would like lock up like pies, and he would be able to like unlock the boxes that they were in.
When he was 7, Eric saw a trapeze artist perform at a traveling circus and immediately decided that he was going to be a trapeze artist.
And not too long after, Eric, Prince of the Air, was a trapeze artist at the age of 9 for the Jack Heffler 5-Cent Circus.
And in 1894, at the age of 20, he joined the Welsh Brothers Circus.
His colleagues included a Japanese balancing act, strongmen, sword swallowers, contortionists, and it was there that he really perfected one of his most famous acts.
This is one of the trunks that he would have used in the metamorphosis trick.
The metamorphosis trick. Houdini did this one with his wife, Bess. His hands are tied behind his back. He gets into a big sack, which is tied shut. The sack, with Houdini in it, is put into a trunk, which is then securely locked.
Bess stands on the trunk and closes a curtain in front of her. She claps 3 times. On the 3rd clap, the curtain opens to reveal not Bess, but Houdini. Bess is tied up inside the sack, which is inside the locked trunk.
Still just a basic big old wooden trunk.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of the appeal, that these everyday objects that he turned into spectacles.
How did he do it?
Magicians never reveal their secrets, and this exhibit doesn't either. The show does showcase other things Houdini escaped from. A milk can, a collection of handcuffs, a straitjacket.
These aren't necessarily everyday objects to everyone.
But they're not inherently magical or rare things either.
We wander over to a silent video showing one of Houdini's escapes in front of a huge crowd.
So he's standing on top of this metal bridge. The policemen are fitting his handcuffs on. All right, we see him, white trunks, climbing up.
There's actually people hanging all over the bridge just to watch it happen. And there he goes.
Splash.
he just jumped into the water, disappears, and like 4 seconds later, he's back out of the water. No handcuffs.
Just immediately.
He was iconic because his magic was good. His escapes were death-defying.
Joe Pond owns Misdirection's Magic Shop near Golden Gate Park.
I've been doing magic since I was a kid, and Houdini is actually one of my big heroes. When you say magic, right away you think of Houdini. In the dictionary, he actually is in Webster's dictionary, Houdini. Look him up. But I just love Houdini.
He loves Houdini.
Anpon says he's not the only one.
Because everybody wants to be Houdini, not just magicians. David Copperfield, Doug Henning, David Blaine, Chris Angel. We all want to be like that, but not just that, but everyone else in the world. Michael Jackson, Madonna. If you think about it, he is iconic to magic, and everybody who is a showman or a show person wants to study the art of being Houdini.
Pond loves magic because it creates a different reality, and that was important in Houdini's day.
During that era, it was the Depression. He is the working man, the guy who's trying to break through the chains.
People crave distraction from their daily problems, the same way they do now. Houdini made their lives more magical.
Back at the Contemporary Jewish Museum's exhibition, there's a black and white photograph of a city street blown up to billboard size. There's an enormous crowd, and they're all looking at Harry Houdini, hanging high above them, upside down, in a straitjacket.
Where is he? There he is.
He's at the very, very top of the mural. It's a humongous mural.
The street is totally filled. It looks like Times Square. Curator Dara Solomon says the picture was taken in
Providence, Rhode Island. And it's unbelievable how many people are there.
It must be the entire population of Rhode Island.
That's what we were just saying. It really seems that way. And they're just all out. Everyone has a hat and coat. So really, you know, you get this real sense of the period. Thousands of people would come out and watch him because they didn't have TVs. This was a time when you would go out on the street to see a spectacle.
Solomon says that kind of public spectacle is less common today, though we might still need it.
We're so used to, you know, being entertained in our homes or in a theater, but to see this on the street, it's way more powerful, I think.
The big crowd photo reveals something else about Houdini. He wasn't just an escape artist. He was also a master of self-promotion. Anytime he came to a new city, he'd perform his stunts in front of the newspaper building, guaranteeing himself some free advertising.
And he did just that in San Francisco in 1923.
He did the straitjacket escape in front of the Hearst building at Market and Third, just right around the corner.
The straitjacket escape. Houdini is strapped into a regulation straitjacket. His arms are firmly crossed across his chest, and the straitjacket's long sleeves are buckled shut at the ends and tied tightly behind his back. He's hoisted up by his ankles and hung upside down from a building. He squares his shoulders.
And then the wriggling starts.
He's got to get one of his arms above his head.
He accomplishes that somehow, and now his arms are free somehow, but his hands aren't. They're still buckled in their sleeves.
So he unbuckles them with his teeth.
His hands now free, Houdini takes off the straitjacket just as easily as a raincoat. Houdini died in 1926 at the age of 52.
He spent the last years of his life debunking people who claimed to have psychic powers.
But that did not mean he lost his own air of mystery.
He picked the best day to die on, too.
Halloween.
There were more than 2,000 mourners at his funeral.
He escaped a life in obscurity and poverty and allowed others a chance to escape the everyday. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Samuel.
And I'm Seth Samuel for Cross Currents.
And with that, we are out for today. Join us again tomorrow at noon and again at 9 p.m. for Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio, and always at wordofmouthradio.org.